Misty. It's one of the most popular American melodies of all time. And the man who composed this beautiful song and hundreds of others was indeed one of the most popular pianists of all time. But Errol Garner was much more than just a popular performer. He was an innovator whose unique approaches to melody, harmony, and rhythm continue to amaze pianists today. Still, while musicians marveled at his innovations, Errol Garner never lost that important connection with the audience. That's because every note he played resonated with pure and honest emotion. I'm Nancy Wilson. This time on Jazz Profiles, Errol Garner, the joy of a genius.
My estimation, the swingingest pianist that ever came along. I haven't heard anybody before or since that could swing any more than this man could.
Not only was he experiencing joy in his performances, but he had that magical ability to communicate that joy and to make his audiences share it. Even people who had no interest in jazz, who would have preferred rock or the classics, loved to watch Errol Garner perform, and that is rare.
The most original pianist, the most unpianistic pianist, taking the piano and making of it an orchestra. We all knew him as Uchiku, and I'm sure there is no explanation for that. Hey, Uchiku, he would say that to me, or I'd say, damn. I said, how's the weather down there?
Yeah. Uchiku, you won't find that listed in Webster's Dictionary. Just like Errol Garner's music, it's part of a unique vocabulary which only he could articulate, but which we all could enjoy. Those were the comments of George Shearing, Steve Allen, and John Levy. During the next hour, we'll hear more from them and others who were close to Errol Garner as we explore the extraordinary career of this great American artist. About every aspect of an Errol Garner performance made people smile. From his warm sense of musical humor to that trademark telephone book he always sat on.
The Manhattan telephone book was just the right size.
Jazz historian Dan Morgenstern.
They would bring that out and put it on the piano bench, and then he would come out and he would bow, and, you know, and he had a great smile. And he had that patent leather hair, you know, to the very end, even though it wasn't in style anymore. That's the way he had his hair. Then he would turn to the audience, and he had that impish look, and he would start to play. One of the ways he pulled people in was the tremendous rhythm he had. I mean, Errol was a phenomenal swinger. I mean, he had tremendous time. And he had a way of, you know, he would love to tag tunes. One particular performance called 3 o'clock in the Morning has this characteristic. He keeps repeating a phrase, and He plays it with a different touch, and he plays it, you know, different registers on the piano, and he just goes along, and he's like teasing you, when is he going to stop, you know, and then boom, then he stops. And all those things, they were like communication of a very special sort.
The Errol Garner Trio and 3 o'clock in the Morning, recorded in 1964. Throughout his career, Garner favored the trio setting, because with the exception of playing solo, it placed the fewest restrictions on his enormous creativity and allowed him to develop his own original style, a style that first emerged amid the steel mills of Pennsylvania. Garner was born on June 15, 1921, in the small Pittsburgh community of East Liberty. Along with his twin brother Ernest, Errol was the youngest of 6 children and grew up in a household filled with music. His father played guitar and his mother piano. Each of his 3 sisters also played piano, and his older brother Linton became an established pianist himself, working in the bands of Fletcher Henderson and Billy Eckstine. Unlike his siblings, Errol never formally studied music, and yet, from as early on as age 3, he was playing piano with both hands. He learned to play in all keys with equal facility and developed his own system of fingering, which later in life would baffle many concert pianists. His ear was so incredibly well-developed that after hearing a piece of music just once, Errol could sit down at the piano and repeat it, note for note. Bassist Wyatt Bull Reuther, who would later play an important role in the Errol Garner Trio, also grew up in East Liberty.
We lived about 10 blocks away from each other. I was fortunate enough to have one of his sisters as my piano teacher because she knew my mother. And when I'd go to Earl's house for my lessons, I would play my lesson, and Earl would come up behind me and play the lesson, the same lesson that I played, and he wouldn't be reading the music. It was very frustrating to me. I didn't know how I could do it at that time.
Errol's inability to read music never stood in the way of his development as a musician. In fact, while attending Westinghouse High School, where he played both piano and tuba, he was actually encouraged not to take lessons by, of all people, his band teacher. But Carl McVicker wasn't just any band teacher. Through his classes had passed some of the finest musicians to emerge from Pittsburgh, including Billy Strayhorn, Amma Jamal, Grover Mitchell, and Wyatt Reuther.
He was a very strong influence on all of us.
Before switching to bass, Reuther studied trombone under Carl McVicker at Westinghouse High School.
He seemed very relaxed, but he was very strict. When you become seniors in high school, you have a tendency to cut class, and if you ever cut his class, you were out of it. But Carl McVicker was a special man. Practically any place Earl was going to work, you could look up and he'd, at one time or another, you'd see Mr. McVicker in the audience.
Errol Garner had God's gift, according to Carl McVicker. And he believed if Errol was tied down to reading notes, it could corrupt his extraordinary natural talent. In 1941, Errol Garner made his first trip to New York. He started out playing for singers, but it soon became clear his style was too dominant for the role of accompanist. After a few years of performing back home in Pittsburgh, he returned to New York for good in 1944.
Errol, when he came to New York, had really a clear idea of what he wanted to do stylistically.
Pianist and educator Billy Taylor.
He didn't feel it was necessary to change. He had decided how he wanted to express himself. And so it wasn't a matter of saying, well, gee, I think I'll play a little like Bud Powell, or I'll take all these things that I'm hearing Charlie Parker do and put them into a pianistic context. He played with Charlie Parker, but he played what he played. And he played with Dizzy Gillespie. He played with all of the principal bebop players. And they loved what he did, but they respected him as an individual player. He epitomized what the older generation looked up to, the fact that here's a guy who comes along and does something which is very personal with his instrument. The things that he did that really communicated with the audience were melodic. I mean, he played these melodies that everybody knew and liked, and they could hear him playing Penthouse Serenade or some popular tune, and they could recognize the melody, and they could also recognize the fact that he was taking liberties with the melody in the same way that Louis Armstrong and other people did. But the melody was there. He was a very melodic player.
From 1949, Errol Garner's signature performance of Penthouse Serenade with John Simmons on bass and Alvin Stoller on drums. Billy Taylor first met Errol Garner in the mid-1940s while both men were playing on New York's famed 52nd Street. It was a time and a place where music was everywhere.
There were 20 clubs in one block of 52nd Street that was between 5th and 6th Avenue. All of these clubs were in the basement of brownstone houses. So what normally would have been a house, these had been turned into speakeasies during Prohibition. All of these clubs were on the ground level, which was the basement of this brownstone. And in some cases, there were people still living upstairs.
Bassist John Levy also worked on 52nd Street and would later take part in Errol's first recording session for Savoy.
I never was so disappointed when I came from Chicago. I was going to work on 52nd Street with the Stuffsmith Trio, and when I walked into the Onyx Club, I was so disappointed, especially in the day. Any club looks terrible in the daytime, but this day was awful looking. And I said, this little joint, I know we're coming here, how are they going to pay us? You know? Never forget, I looked at this place, God, this place don't hold anybody, you know. But every night, boy, they were in there, jammed in there. And you play a set and then get off, and then when you got off, maybe somebody from down, Errol might be from down the street, come in and he'd sit down on the piano and he'd start playing in there. Something going on all the time.
Second Street was important, not just because of its tremendous volume of music, but also because of the great variety it featured. In one club, you might hear a traditional New Orleans-style band. Next door, it might be swing-era veterans like Roy Eldridge or Ben Webster. And down the street were the new sounds of Dizzy Gillespie, Bud Powell, and Charlie Parker. 52nd Street was a sort of jazz intersection, a place where ideas and experience were passed along not only between, but within generations. George Shearing.
I was playing intermission piano opposite Sarah Vaughan in the Onyx Club here with just Jimmy Jones at the piano. And then I played opposite Errol Garner, Oscar Pettiford and J.C. Hurd. And then I'm supposed to go on with all my English reservation. I'm supposed to go on and slay everybody. I tell you, that was probably a priceless apprenticeship.
Mm-hmm. Jumpin' at the Deuces from 1945, featuring Errol Garner on piano and Slam Stewart on bass with his trademark wordless vocal. You're listening to Errol Garner, The Joy of a Genius, on this edition of NPR's Jazz Profiles. I'm Nancy Wilson. Errol Garner received a warm reception on 52nd Street because his style appealed to everyone. Older players loved his attention to melody and that undeniable swing, while younger players appreciated his complex harmonic approach and tremendous technique. But the thing that most amazed both generations was Errol's ability to play left and right hand passages that were completely independent of one another, not unlike the various sections of a big band. Jazz historian Dan Morgenstern.
Although he was certainly influenced by pianists like Earl Hines and Fats Waller, it was the big bands that really influenced him. And he sounded like a whole band. He had all those colors and his whole dynamic contrast, which was another thing that he had.
Well, he played full piano, and that's the thing that I think really got to most of the older players.
Pianist Billy Taylor.
He could play stride very well along with Fats Waller lines, but he had his own take on how to do that. And he was doing these things with the harmony in his right hand, which gave it a very full orchestral sound.
From 1953, Will You Still Be Mine, with Wyatt Bull Reuther on bass and Eugene Fats Heard on drums. Of all the stylistic trademarks that made Garner's sound so original, the right-hand rubato, the octave melodies, the dramatic shifts in dynamics, perhaps none was as distinctive nor so often imitated as that steady four to the bar left hand.
When the other pianists at parties or whatever do the impression of Errol, it always involves the strange guitar-like use of the left hand.
Steve Allen.
Let's see. See, the left hand just pumps. Sometimes he would go that jabam jabam instead of bump bump.
Bassist John Levy.
Some people said it was like the bass line, but it wasn't the bass line to me. It was like a guitar player playing chords, full chords, but with a rhythm, you know, like that chopping beat that a guitar can get, like Freddie Green was with Basie. That's the way Errol's left hand was. It was like Freddie Green playing guitar all the time and playing those full chords. And still keeping time, keeping the rhythm going. And he might be doing anything with his right hand, all kinds of stuff with his right hand, offbeat stuff, but that left hand was steady going.
Another signature aspect of any Garner performance was how he would begin songs with those mysterious and often lengthy introductions that always kept you guessing. Dan Morgenstern.
The introductions were designed as little teasers. He wouldn't announce anything, of course, so what was he going to play? Well, the introductions were very elaborate and sometimes some real avant-garde stuff that he would play. And then there were little clues maybe as to what that was going to be. And then, boom, he would hit it and go into time, and he would get that big recognition applause.
He would start something, and he would modulate through different keys and change tempos, and he would do all kinds of funny little things. They were all from a good musical point of view, but they were all improvised, and they were all right off the top of their head. And it allowed him to be extremely creative harmonically, melodically, and rhythmically for about 2 or 3 minutes before he actually introduced the melody that he was going to do.
Wagner made his first recordings for the Savoy label in 1945. While he was already well known within New York jazz circles, it was his version of Laura that first introduced the Errol Garner sound to a much broader audience.
It was a tune that was very popular at the time. You know, it was a hit, and the movie had been a hit. But Errol's approach to that was, you know, it was so distinctive. It was that sound he got from the piano, even though Savoy, you know, couldn't quite capture that. But it was that romantic outpouring, you know, that really brought out the melody, and it didn't sound like anybody else. I mean, by now, it's been imitated so much, it's hard to remember how fresh it was when you first heard it.
Steve Allen.
Errol had the ability to convey two types of emotion. One is the one associated with the word happy. There was that sense of joyousness in his playing. And the second was, of course, the one that played ballads. There was simply no other popular pianist who had the ability to transmit that much romanticism, that much, if the song justified it, melancholy.
Yeah, you know, Errol was capable. He could make you cry. He could make you laugh, and he could make you cry. I mean, he, you know, he had that thing.
That thing, as Dan Morgenstern calls it, was Errol's ability to relate with the listener on a purely emotional level. And perhaps because he communicated so well with the popular music audiences, Errol Garner occasionally encountered criticism.
There were certain bebop proselytizers who might have sort of patronized Errol because he didn't fit in. You know, Errol was unto himself. He wasn't a bebop piano player. So there were people who said, oh, you know, Errol Garner, he's okay, but, you know, Bud Powell, I mean, that's it. But how about his recordings with Charlie Parker? Errol could play with anybody, and Bird was the same way. They were a perfect match, and what did they play? They played blues, and I Got Rhythm Changes.
Cool Blues, recorded February 19th, 1947, featuring Errol Garner at the piano and Charlie Parker on alto saxophone. Percussionist Jose Mangual worked with both Bird and Garner. He was on the 1951 recording, Charlie Parker South of the Border, and spent close to a decade touring and recording with Errol.
Charlie was a little easier, because Charlie only plays melody and just, you know, makes it solo. But Errol plays the melody, and he plays breaks, and he plays things that you never heard before on the piano. This guy was crazy. It was impossible.
Impossible to comprehend, yet so easy to appreciate. That may be the best way to describe the extraordinary artistry of the man they called the most happy piano. Still to come, the story of two musical milestones, Concert by the Sea and Misty. I'm Nancy Wilson, and you're listening to Errol Garner, The Joy of a Genius, on Jazz Profiles from NPR. National Public Radio.
And now here he is, the star of our show, Steve Allen.
As the original host of The Tonight Show, and throughout his television career, Steve Allen has made a point of showcasing great jazz artists.
Almost all of my television programs have had studio audiences, but there was always a rare kind of excitement when Earl Garner played, particularly when he played up-tempo things. The audience, first of all, could be observed to be smiling, which they would not always do, let's say, if listening to Oscar Peterson. They might be open-mouthed in awe listening to Oscar, but the smiling thing would be unlikely to happen. But with Earl, there would be this happy look on the audience's faces, and then an actual cheer when he finished. And sometimes cheers would happen during the performance.
One of my favorite record albums, which I picked up not long ago, is this one here. It's called The Most Happy Piano. And as you can see by the name here, the fellow who is the star of this album and who is going to play for you right now is one of the most exciting jazz pianists to ever come over the pike. Let's give him a real welcome, Earl Garner. Here he is.
Garner's popularity continued to rise throughout the 50s and 60s and well into the 1970s. He recorded dozens of albums, appeared regularly on television and radio, and toured around the world. Wyatt Ruther.
Now, you've got to realize in those days the audiences were starving for the kind of music Earl was playing because it was the introduction of what was then called bebop, or progressive music. And Earl was still playing, these are my words, the simplest form of jazz. And inside that simple form, he was doing his thing. And that's how it worked. And it worked every time. He reached everybody.
It's All Right With Me, performed by the Earl Garner Trio on The Steve Allen Show in 1957. The one person most responsible for broadening Garner's exposure, while at the same time elevating his status as an artist, was Martha Glaser, his personal manager, producer, and friend for nearly three decades. She believed Earl deserved the same treatment given to classical performers, and she made sure he played only the best venues, stayed in the finest hotels, and always had a decent piano for his performances. Martha broke new ground when she booked Garner into the prestigious Cleveland Music Hall in 1950. It marked the first instance of a solo jazz performer appearing in a traditionally classical concert hall. Later, Earl became the first and only jazz artist to perform under the auspices of classical impresario Sol Hurok.
But it was really quite something when Hurok was presenting Earl.
Producer George Avakian.
I remember a performance at the Hotel Plaza in New York. There was Earl with all these people who looked like Hollywood's version of a Carnegie Hall audience, you know. In fact, I think there were people there in evening clothes, you know, black tie and all that. And they were just bopping along, having a wonderful time, along with the rest of us.
Through tours arranged by Martha Glaser and Sol Hurok, Earl Garner became an international sensation, regularly performing in Europe, South America, and the Far East.
The audience used to love Earl more over there than they did here. And they loved him here, but over there it was incredible.
Jose Mangual was with Garner during many of those tours and recalls some of Earl's most ardent admirers were classical pianists.
The concert pianists, especially in France, They used to get the first row of seats for them to watch Earl play. His fingering was his own fingering, because he never studied, you know, so his fingering was all messed up. And this guy used to look at him and say, like, it's incredible what this guy's doing with the wrong fingering. You could tell these people were amazed at looking at this kind of thing. I said, this little guy sitting on the piano doing all that. How could that be?
In addition to his many concert appearances, Garner made an enormous number of recordings during his career. Just like on stage, he was completely uninhibited in the studio. There were never any rehearsals, and the repertoire was usually decided on the spot. Wyatt Reuther recalls a session with George Avakian of Columbia Records that took place while the trio was appearing in Ontario, Canada. One day between performances, they drove down to New York and met Martha Glaser in the studio.
She would come out of the booth and stand beside Earl and name the tunes. Now, while she's naming the tunes, he's doodling on the piano. And then he'd pick one. And all he'd do is nod to Martha, and all of a sudden Martha disappears. And Fats and I knew, okay, something's coming up. But that's how we did 23 first takes for Columbia, for George Avakian. You almost had a fit in that booth.
Garner recorded a number of successful albums for Columbia throughout the 50s. It was a session he did for another label that would produce his most famous record. In 1954, Garner released an album on the Mercury label that included several well-known standards and a few original tunes, including one he had composed after observing a beautiful rainbow through the window of an airplane. Although it was untitled then, that tune would ultimately become one of the most memorable melodies of all time. Wyatt Reuther played bass on the original recording of Misty.
First time I heard it was in Baltimore. And I asked him what it was. He says, oh, it's just something I made up. And that's all he had to say about it. And then we recorded it, and boom, he's got a hit. But when people like Sarah Vaughan, who was a Carmen McRae, everybody, all the singers, took that tune, I think that's what set the tune off.
To this day, Misty remains one of the most recognized and requested songs of all time. Errol Garner actually composed hundreds of songs, including beautiful ballads like Dreamy and Solitaire. But Misty took on a life of its own. It's been immortalized on records by Sarah Vaughan and Johnny Mathis, on television as the Today Show theme, and on film, thanks to the Clint Eastwood thriller, Play Misty for Me. However, it was a recording made a short time after Misty that would eventually become Errol Garner's biggest seller, and which many believe was his crowning achievement. The album was called Concert by the Sea, and it opened with this masterful arrangement of I'll Remember April.
Thank you.
Concert by the Sea was recorded September 19, 1955, in an auditorium on the Fort Ord Army Base in California. It was Errol Garner's first live recording, and it captured nearly every aspect of his incredible artistry. The swinging excitement, the romanticism, the humor, and the element of surprise. But perhaps the biggest surprise of all was how Concert by the Sea ever became an album in the first place. The original purpose for the recording was to allow troops who could not attend the concert the chance to hear it later on the base's intercom system. But once Martha Glaser heard it, she realized this was no ordinary performance. She sent a copy of the tape to George Ivakhin at Columbia.
Well, the recording wasn't too great, but the performance was unbelievable. The engineers at Columbia and I worked on it. We patched up spots where the mics, and I guess it was just one mic, really, couldn't quite take a crescendo by Errol, but in the finished product, I don't even know where the places are that we fixed. And it ended up being the biggest selling jazz album in history up to that time, and is still one of the great landmarks.
Billy Taylor.
That's the one record that seems to really capture the man. Wide variety, lots of swinging things, lovely ballads, songs that you may not have been familiar with, but which you soon learn the melody too, because it was a simple melody. He just had so many elements in that one record that it was inevitable that it would become the big hit that it was.
And even though it came out as a monaural recording in the early period of stereo, that didn't hurt it at all. I think that you could have put that album out on Edison cylinder, right, that would have sold. So it's always, as we like to say in the business, what's in the groove that counts.
I'll Remember April, performed by the Errol Garner Trio, with Eddie Calhoun on bass and Denzel Best on drums. I'm Nancy Wilson, and you're listening to Errol Garner, The Joy of a Genius, on NPR's Jazz Profiles. By 1957, Errol Garner was the biggest-selling jazz artist on the Columbia label, a label which at that time included Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, Dave Brubeck, who was a close second, and a young trumpeter named Miles Davis. Such commercial success meant Errol could undertake projects of his own choosing, and like many of the great soloists in jazz, one thing he wanted to do was record with strings. Dan Morgenstern.
Every jazz musician who has a sense of melody, and that all the great ones do, you know, likes to work with strings. Charlie Parker with strings, of course, is maybe the most famous case in point. It's a natural.
Billy Taylor.
I think one of the most significant things about Errol doing this was that it was a well-known fact that he did not read music. And so for him to be treated in the same way that the traditionally trained concert artists were treated and given the same respect to play his music instead of having to make concessions as people like George Gershwin and James P. Johnson and many of the people who play jazz. The orchestra, in this case, had to play with their own.
Producer George Ivakian.
People were making albums with strings in those days, and Errol wanted to do it, and I said, well, who would you like to have do the arrangements? I said, oh, I'll do it myself. And I thought to myself, well, I don't want to embarrass Errol by saying, Errol, you're going to write the arrangements and you don't read music. But he anticipated that, and he said, I'll just simply dictate what I want in the string parts, and somebody can write it down, and that's the way we'll do it. This was the only time that I think ever that somebody who was a jazz performer did an album with strings, and he, quote, unquote, wrote the arrangements.
From the album Other Voices, the beautiful ballad This Is Always, featuring Errol Garner with orchestra conducted by Mitch Miller. Whether alone at the piano or in front of an entire orchestra, Errol Garner drew from his instrument as much music as he could possibly produce. Had he been born with 11 fingers, he once remarked in an interview, he would have played even more piano. That passion was inspired not just by the music of piano greats like Art Tatum and Earl Father Hines, whom he admired, but by all the music his extraordinary ears could take in. And as the expression goes, Errol had big ears. He listened to everything from pop tunes to gypsy violinist to European classical music. Often between road trips, he would stop in at The Colony, a New York record store where, at one time, Dan Morgenstern was employed.
He was one of the few customers who was allowed to go behind the counter. And I remember him coming in there and picking out about 35 LPs of all kinds, including a lot of mood music, you know, stuff like Percy Faith or Mantovani or whatever, and also a lot of jazz things and singers. And so he, you know, grabbed this big stack of LPs, and he was going to take all that stuff on the road with him.
Just like his colleagues, Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, Errol Garner was intrigued by the rhythms of Latin America. In 1954, he recorded an album featuring the percussionist Candido. And after the introduction of bossa nova in the mid-60s, he made Latin percussion a permanent part of his group. That attraction started during Errol's 52nd Street days. That's when he first heard the Afro-Cuban sounds of Machito and his highly influential 16-piece orchestra. José Mangual.
Usually used to follow whatever new was coming out, you know, all the new styles and the new music, and he would play it, especially with Machito's band. Had such a good rhythm and good arrangements, and that's what that was his fascination with the band. He was crazy about the band.
While the conga drum became a regular part of Errol's later groups, it never competed with his own incredible sense of rhythm, nor did it diminish in any way his wonderful creativity and purely original approach. From 1974, Errol Garner, joined by Bob Cranshaw on bass, Greedy Tate on drums, and Jose Mangual on percussion. Michel Legrand's Watch What Happens. In the late 1960s and early 70s, when the public's interest in jazz was waning, Errol Garner remained as popular as ever. He continued to perform in sold-out venues around the world until in 1975, his declining health forced him to stop. On February 21st of that year, he checked into a Chicago hospital and was first diagnosed with viral pneumonia. Later it became clear Errol was suffering from lung cancer. He returned to his home in Southern California, where he underwent surgery, but the cancer had spread too far. Over the next year and a half, radiation therapy gave him some remission, and Errol's health seemed to be improving. Then on December 14, 1976, he was admitted to Cedars-Sinai Medical Clinic in Los Angeles for shortness of breath and a severe cough. At his own request, he was released on December 29th, and 4 days later, on January 2nd, 1977, Errol Garner died at the age of 55.
He called me here 1 week before he died. He called me here, and he said, Jose, since we haven't been working for 2 years, we have a lot of contracts, and we're going to work 6 months straight, and we're going to go as far as Russia, and we're going to go to Alaska, and they named all the places. And I was so happy, you know. It's not because of the work, because that he told me he was feeling better. And a week later, after that, my son called me here and told me about he had passed. Well, that was something.
That was a very surprising thing. I can still see that pixie smile. He was a great guy. Let's put it like that. He was a great guy. I loved that little guy.
One of the most important lessons that Errol can leave for any aspiring musician, the fact that he was able to be tremendously popular without compromising his integrity as a musician.
Throughout his impressive career, this humble pianist from Pittsburgh remained true not only to his art, but to his spirit as well. He loved playing the piano, and he also loved to share his enjoyment with others. It truly was the joy of his genius that made Errol Garner one of the world's most popular pianists and a true giant in jazz.
Errol was in a class by himself. People ask me, how do you rate him alongside so-and-so? I don't, period.
It was a language, and it was his own language. That way he had of communicating with an audience, he was a total original. We'll never see anything like him again.
Every time he played piano, you could hear the smile in his touch. You could hear the smile in his rhythmic approach. And it's hard to imagine Errol Garner having a bad day. And he must have had them. But he didn't share them with us because he knew that they didn't belong to us. If a tune does not smile, it doesn't belong to Errol Garner.
The Joy of a Genius was written and produced by Paul Connolly. Special thanks to Martha Glazer, Linton Garner, Benny Green, Gary Vercelli, and Nick Dragos. Thanks also to Meadow Lane Enterprises, the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University, and member station KXJZ Sacramento. Jazz Profiles is produced by Tim Owens. Executive producers Mary Beth Kirshner and Murray Horwitz. For more information about Jazz Profiles, this program, and a listing of future programs in this series, look for NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web at npr.org. That's npr.org. Major support for Jazz Profiles comes from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people make the arts a part of their everyday lives. Additional support has been provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Nancy Wilson, saying jazz is as pure as the life we live. So live it. This is NPR, National Public Radio.